to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Rogue. Each week, we design spicy modern decks geared at tournament play. We put our creations to the test in competitive leagues and share our findings on the air. If you would like to support Faithless Brewing, please help us spread the word. You can leave us a review on iTunes. We would really appreciate that. Follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. Or come find us on the Modern subreddit at r/modernmagic. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Episode 6 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. Joining me as always is Damon Alexander. Damon, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good. And back from the West Coast is Dan Schreiber, or Cave Dan, on MTGO. How's it going, Dan?
I'm doing really well. How are you guys?
Enjoying summer. It's finally here.
Yeah, it's a sunny day in Seattle right now.
I'm glad to hear that because I just came back from like a 10-day vacation to the Bay Area. I was in a place called Dillon Beach, which is, I guess it's like an hour north of San Francisco. And so I brought all my beach clothes. I was like, California beach, let's go. It was so cold. It was freezing. I needed like a winter coat. It was windy. It was incredible. Gorgeous views, but they should really call that something else. Dillon Wind Bluffs or something like that.
I mean, you are in NorCal, so that's kind of on you.
Yeah, it's a classic SF tourist mistake is to not pack like sweatshirts and stuff.
Right. The Minnesotan in you still.
Go to LA.
But it's good to be back.
Now, Dan, you've got a new Twitter feed that you're tweeting out to the people from. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that our podcast Twitter feed. We are at FaithlessMTG, which I have mentioned in the previous episodes just in the lead up, and if anyone had followed us previously, you might have noticed it was just a barren wasteland because I'm a millennial in name only. I barely understand technology and social media. But during the past week while on vacation, I tried to learn how to use Twitter, and I've been tweeting stuff out from the account. So if you follow us at FaithlessMTG, you will find not only announcements of when we have a new episode up, but all kinds of fun stuff. You have screenshots from our testing, a lot of my random brew ideas, cards that I think will work together in Modern Horizons, and potentially some spoilers of future episodes, or just some sweet text. You can follow us there, get the ideas, and think of it first. So yeah, so give us a follow there.
You'll have gone from a barren wasteland to just the normal wasteland of social media in the modern world.
Yes, just tweeting out thoughts into the void. Yes, pearls before swine, but there aren't even any swine around to eat it up.
Speaking of big announcements, I believe today the word came down from on high that officially the London Mulligan Rule will be the Mulligan Rule going forward for all competitive events in all formats, starting with the next set. So not with Modern Horizons, but with the next Standard Legal set. I believe that comes out in a month or two. Any reactions to that, Damon, from a modern perspective? We did just have the last, no longer called Pro Tour, but Mythic Championship with this rule, and it seemed to influence some of the pros' deck choices.
Yeah, I mean, one thing is that I saw a lot more of the Neoform Allosaurus combo during the time where the London Mulligan was available. And that deck was maybe not the my favorite deck to be playing against all the time online, but I'm sure that if things like that go too crazy, Wizards will do something about it. They may have to consider banning new cards or unbanning some cards or printing new cards. But I'm sure that it sounds like they did it with a lot of data behind their decision, where they look at, you know, conditional probabilities of a player winning if they mulled a 6 versus if they mulled a 5. And it sounds like things got a lot better with the London Mull, which makes a lot of sense given how it played out. I think it's overall changed for the better.
Did they talk at all in the announcement about their reasoning behind the decision or any of the data that they gathered?
Yeah, I think they look at the data for... Like, I mean, the word non-game is kind of hard to quantify, but I think they have a massive data set on MTGO that they have available to them where they can just say, like, how many games were won by a player who mulled to 5 versus a player who, like, neither player mulliganed. And if the win rate is, like, a lot worse than players mulling to 5, is just making the games non-games.
Now, do you think do you get a little suspicious? This is conspiracy David talking. They never shared that data in the announcement. They claimed they had lots of data. They had all kinds of information from the Pro Tour. They published none of it. So I get a little suspicious when they have all this data that suggests something and then it's not presented to the public to actually make their own assessments.
Yeah, they could be trying to sell all their new London Mulligan swag. I have this Vancouver Mulligan t-shirt I have to get rid of now, but oh well.
Oh my God.
No, I trust their data. I mean, I think that they just don't want to release the data to the public because my understanding, I actually wasn't really playing too much when they were doing this, but when they used to release every 5-0 deck, I think it led to like formats being solved too quickly, and somehow that's just like not good for the health of the game.
Yeah,
I don't trust their analysis with my life, but I'm sure it's something. They have smart people there.
They've taken that stance on sort of a medium amount of data for some time now. There was like an intermediate period between them publishing all the 5-0 lists where they would just pick 5 a day, however many there were, 20, 30, you know, for any format standard. They would just pick 5 random ones and publish those. And the people were upset about that because, you know, we need data to at least have content to talk about. But they eventually settled on this sort of 20-card different algorithm that people, I think, have settled into that rhythm for the past, I don't know, what has it been, almost a year now where they've been doing that. But yeah, I think it's rare that they've gone so far as to show like matchup data or win rates for specific decks, except in the context of talking about, retroactively talking about something that was banned or not.
I do think in Modern, there's a little bit of a interesting tension there where a non-game, sure, is you are down cards and lose because you have 5 instead of 7. But because sideboards are so important in Modern, I think there's maybe more non-games, even when the person with a smaller hand wins, where they draw their one piece of hate that the other deck can't beat because there are so many nonsense decks in Modern. So I wonder if the number of, at least in Modern, non-games will be the same, but it's hard to track by this sort of simplistic metric of does a player who mulligans a 5 win or lose.
Yeah, I mean, just going off feel, the London Mulligan felt pretty good to me. It didn't feel like it swung the matchup percentages too much towards one deck or another in various matchups. It just felt like whenever you mulligan, you had like a little bit better of a shot of not getting, like having a double mull.
I did think it was interesting at the Mythic Championship how many pros played Tron, which I think kind of raised a lot of eyebrows, but I think the win percentage was only 47%, and many of those wins came from Yuya Watanabe, who was stacking his deck. So, you know, I the people that are talking about, oh, they might have to ban Tron now, I think that is a really sky is falling perspective. I mean, 47 win percent with the best players in the world is not impressing me much.
I don't want to make too much of that number, because it was the most played deck, which was itself surprising, and, you know, before the matches were played, you looked at the field and saw that Tron had suddenly come out of nowhere to be the most played deck, you would say, ah, yes, this is definitely the London Mulligan. Right? The pros have figured it out that this Mulligan breaks Tron. Like, you always have turn 3 Tron if you're willing to mull to 4. That was a theory anyway. And then I'm not sure like how much actually playing out the matches should affect our assessment of that, because when it's the most played deck in the field, like, its overall win rate has to be close to 50. It's hard to get higher than that. Second, I think, you know, Tron is a comfortable deck or a comforting deck for players who are maybe not Modern specialists. It's a forgiving deck, so I think a lot of people just were playing it without that much tuning. And then it was an open deck lists format, so there are like all kinds of hands where, I mean, you know this. You look at your starting 7, like, this hand is okay as long as they're not on Tron. If you know they're on Tron, you just mulligan that hand and go for something faster. So I think the open deck list policy at the London Mythic Championship makes us that we can't make too much of the matchup win results from that tournament.
Well, and this is why you don't design a DOE with multiple confounding variables, because our major data point we're being told that this is acceptable is the Mythic Championship. And then they, like, you bring up a great point that it was confounded by the fact that you knew that if you were playing Tron or not every round after the first constructed round.
So, yeah, I don't know what to make of that. I'm not looking forward to playing against more Tron, but I guess that just is what it is. I've made my peace with Tron. The Allosaurus deck that you mentioned, Damon, is interesting because there was a banned restricted announcement, like, what, 3 weeks ago maybe, where they specifically mentioned that deck as one that they had their eye on. And they said that what they've seen so far was that it's not a problem, that it's actually not winning that much despite hype or hysteria you might come across on Reddit or Twitter about people posting their screenshots of, you know, turn 1 kills or something. I know that our experience has been that it's very easy to defeat that deck with basically anything.
To be fair, we were playing a deck that happened to have like Neoform into Lavinia Azorius Renegade, which when you're piloting most other decks in Modern is not a line you have available.
I played against this deck just yesterday in a league, and in game one, my hand happened to have a discard spell, so I easily won that game. And then in game two, because he knew I was on a discard deck, you know, I had some number of Thalassi's in Inquisition, he just ran out Allosaurus Rider on turn one and tried to get there with that without the combo, just tried to beat me down with Allosaurus Rider, which ironically was probably his best out. He got me down to one life before he eventually died. So, I mean, those end up being non-games, and I feel like it's their fault it's a non-game. Like, they chose to play that deck that doesn't actually do anything and can't interact. I don't know. I think that deck is not real, even with Alinda Mulligan.
Didn't they recently get a high performance in a Modern tournament? Even with the Vancouver Mulligan?
Got one top finish in maybe one of the Magic Online events. But, I mean, lately it's been Dredge and Blue-White. Those have been the good decks. And then Is It Phoenix to a lesser degree on the Star City Tour.
Yeah. I mean, I think that maybe we all hope that the deck has not become a Tier 1 deck, just because it does really kind of suck to just lose on turn 1. It just isn't really fun for anybody.
And even when you beat it also feels like they didn't do anything. Like, it doesn't feel like you're playing Magic one way or the other.
Yeah.
Well, from a deck that doesn't interact much to a card we tried to brew around last week that puts a premium on interaction is Dreadhorde Arcanist. We kind of brewed up, I'd say, two general shells. One was a Dreadhorde Arcanist shell that involved sort of like a Jund-style deck that used, you know, Inquisition of Kozilek, Thoughtseize, and a bunch of other one-mana spells to sort of accrue value throughout the game. And then we had kind of another series of decks that tried to use, you know, Mutagenic Growth, Become Immense. We were talking about using some Wizard synergies to sort of combo kill or you know, an aggro deck, but with sort of a combo finish. Damon, I think you played the first league, and you played kind of a tweaked out teamer version of one of the sort of aggro combo versions.
Yeah, so the first list I decided to try, not because it seemed like the best list, but just because it looked pretty fun, was a rug list featuring all the prowess creatures, namely Monastery Swiftspear, Soulscar Mage, one Storm Chaser Mage, and then two Adelies of Cinderwind, just because who knows if that card is any good or not, but it looks fun. And then some Bolts, some traditional blue cantrips, four Atarka's Command, and four Mutagenic Growth. And then a few other random cards like Become Immense, and then just like a 19 land mana base. The list was pretty fun. It had trouble because the first two games, matches I played were against control decks, and I just had kind of trouble drawing enough creatures, and they would just path, snap, path, and all of a sudden I just had no creatures left. And so at a 16 creature deck, it felt like a little bit too light on that. But the deck ultimately felt like it had a pretty high power level. I mean, let me just ask you a question. If you have a, let's just say you have a Soulscar Mage, a Dreadhorde Arcanist, and an Adelies out, and a Tarkus Command in hand, how much damage is that? And you're in these matches, and you start doing the calculation, you're like, actually, I don't really know how much damage it is, but this is clearly more than their life total is, so I'm just going to do it. And hope they don't concede before I get to see what their life total goes to. But if you just do the math of how that line works out, you play the Tarkus Command, you deal three and pump your team. Adelies pumps your team again, so you get a total of, I think each Tarkus Command does 10 damage, and now your Dreadhorde Arcanist has more than enough power to recast it, so you get another 10 damage, so that's 20 damage alone off the Tarkus Command plus the creature's base power. And if you add in a single other cantrip, it just goes even higher. And so the deck can really turn the corner in a hurry. But one thing that sucks is if you, you know, against like the blue-white decks, they just keep bouncing your creatures and only a few of them have haste. So the deck felt like it had a good power level, but the list was not there. It might actually have been worth tuning some. The mana base I didn't quite do right, and maybe up the creature count. But that was a pretty good point to transition to trying some different lists, which you guys did next, right?
I'm sorry. Can we just real quick? So what was your impression of Adelies? Did that seem like a card that was worth playing, or was it, you know, three mana for a card that you know, oftentimes it's attacking for two the turn it comes into play? I mean, did that seem playable, or do you think maybe the sort of aggro shell is good and maybe Adelies just isn't quite at the modern power level?
It's hard to say. It felt like every time I cast Adelies, I was like, man, this card was a draft superstar, but it feels great here too. Even though it still felt like a draft superstar. It really provided just like a ton of damage potential. Like you see Serum Visions and you see an Adelies somewhere in the two cards you're scrying. You're like, oof, I got to get this card going next turn. Like that's exciting. That's some pretty big game. And it usually delivered on that promise, especially with mutagenic growth to immediately get the trigger bonus if you only have 3 mana. So I was impressed with the card and the way it played out. I think we discussed in a recent week about how haste and flying together are pretty good at coming down and eating up planeswalkers. And Adelaide actually delivers at a mere 3 CMC. But it has this sort of anti-synergy with some of the other cards in the deck. Like, it doesn't like Swift Spear because Swift Spear isn't a wizard. So I would say that it doesn't really seem like modern, quite modern level, but like it's fun. And if you are at all interested, I recommend giving it a try.
What do you think about a deck that really like bends the mana and at 2 mana plays Dark Confidant and the Arcanist? So now your wizard count is way up and your card advantage sort of engines are also there.
I mean,
you probably have to maybe get rid of your Delve spell at that point. I mean, we'd have to figure it out, but worth pursuing or Adelaide's just isn't really worth the juice isn't worth the squeeze.
That sounds interesting. That would take a little bit more thought. The mana would get a little bit crazy at some point. With this deck alone, it was tough managing the mana sometimes. Although you do have the mana Morphosis to help out in a pinch. I mean, I guess you could also just cut the green and focus more on like Grixis Wizards.
Yeah, and you can still play Mutagenic Growth without any green lands in your deck. If you're going to kill them on turn 3, it doesn't really matter what your life total is.
Yeah. My main hesitation is just that Dark Confidant kind of feels like a grindy card. It wants the game to go a little bit longer, so you just get more card advantage. And the rest of the deck is kind of trying to finish the game faster.
I often hear people use the phrase, you know, is it Wizards or blank Wizards? Like, hopefully this deck will be good now. There aren't any Wizard Tribal cards. Like, there's only 2, right? There's Wizard's Lightning, which gives you additional lightning bolts, which, as we talked about, I think, last week, you can't really use that with the Arcanist because it has a CMC3. And then there's the Adelaide, which may or may not be playable. And those are the only 2 cards that really reward you for playing Wizards. I mean, I do like Dark Confidant for other reasons.
I believe that is correct. Although, if you're starting to play Mutagenic Growth, maybe you can flashback the Wizard's Lightning. Or Adelaide's buffing your Wizards.
Okay. All right. So get the Wizard's Lightning in there as well.
Just like Tribal Lightning Bolt is probably the best tribe more than Wizards, is what I'm saying. Okay. I know Jeff Hoogland was playing a list that was like 4 Snapcaster Mage, 4 Soulscar Mage. I don't know if he played Adelaide's, but it was just like bolts with a little bit of sort of counter magic. And he was having some success with that. Vendilion Click is also a wizard, if that's an avenue you want to go down.
Yeah, I remember that deck. I remember he had a good run. It must have been an SCG Open.
Yeah, I think he top 8.
Sometime in the past year. I was playing at the SCG Invitational last summer. I think Kevin Jones had brought like a blue-red wizard deck. I was on Restoration Angel, which ate many of his wizards. He was not happy about that. He showed me some spell pierces at the end of the match. He was like, 2 spell pierces in hand. He thought he had it. He thought he had it wrapped up, but nope. Got him
Damon was leaving his opponents as Smoking Craters. Dan, you and I kind of pursued the more like value-oriented Arcanist list. You want to talk about your experience with that?
Yeah, so the first list that I tried was actually card for card, the one that you'd sketched out for us last week, David. So this is a Grixis Value Arcanist, and it's the list that we posted on the website in conjunction with the episode. The only card I changed was I took out one of the Bedlam Revelers because I suspected there was a little bit too much graveyard dependency. I took out one of those for a Saheeli Sublime Artificer, and then I felt like I maybe had 1 too many lands, I think. So I went down to 20 lands, and with the extra slot, I added Haze of Rage, which, you know, Damon was telling us about its legacy debut recently. So I figured, why not? So why not try the Haze of Rage in Modern? I have
now that we knew what it did, we should probably...
Exactly. So yeah, with 4 Young Pyromancers and 1 Saheeli, I figured there was a chance. There was a chance. And that card did stone nothing. I think I drew it twice. Both times I drew it, I was thinking like, okay, I'm gonna try to kill them with this, but like the game was already wrapped up, but with other cards that actually had text. So I will not be playing that one again in this show.
Yeah, that card showed up in the legacy Blue Red Delver Arcanist lists. And in the most recent MTGO challenge, there were a ton of Blue Red Delver lists in the top 8 and top 32, and they tended not to be running Haze of Rage. So maybe that card is not meant to be.
Well, nevertheless, the shell seemed pretty decent. I think I went 4-1 with my first league with it. I didn't really like the deck that much, even though I was winning with it. It felt like felt like just sort of like a pile of Grixis cards. It had some plausible cantrips, some plausible removal, and some decent value creatures, all of which have very low power. But, you know, they all provided good value. It took so long to deal 20 damage. Like, even the games where I was well ahead, where, you know, we'd postulated that an Arcanist, if uncontested, will function like a Dark Confidant and just sort of sending you ahead a card every turn. You know, plus you're getting tempo advantage because you didn't pay mana for that card. And that was happening, but I was still like, they'd be at like 15 life. I'd be at like 7 life because I had to shock fetch so many times, took some chip damage, cast some Thought Seizes, and I'd still be like in grave danger of losing, even though I was like 4 cards up off cantrips. So that was like a little disconcerting. The only way to actually close the game was to get a young Pyromancer who kind of overperformed for me. He actually seemed pretty good, not just in conjunction with the Arcanist, although that was a nice synergy as well. But I just sort of liked him in most matchups. So maybe it's time to go revisit young Pyromancer. That was one of my takeaways from this.
Yeah, and I played a similar list. I changed a few more cards around, but yeah, that was my sense as well. The deck just felt a little clunky. Snapcaster Mage and Dreadhorde Arcanist kind of use the same resources from the graveyard. Snapcaster Mage is really a 3-mana play. So, you know, you don't have a lot of 2-mana plays that you can kind of play aggressively if you, you know, attack their hand on turn 1. And yeah, like you said, Dan, I mean, it takes forever to kill them. I mean, you can feel like you're up the whole game and they still have multiple live draws because of how powerful some of these modern decks are to, quote unquote, steal a game from you at the end.
Yeah, so I noticed as that scenario kept coming up that it was a little bit troubling that our range of spells was pretty narrow because we were choosing 1-mana spells. So our removal was Lightning Bolt and Push, which doesn't actually kill every creature in Modern. Like, it's not going to kill a Wyrmcoil Engine or even a Gurmag Angler. It's not going to stop them from burning you out. Like, we can discard things in their hand. We don't have any counter magic. So it felt like, you know, we were often like ahead, but still like a long way from the finish line.
Yeah, playing a deck that's slow without counter magic really leaves you vulnerable to a variety of top decks on turns like 4 through 8. So now, you thought one way to maybe combat that was to play Death Shadow. So you're doing so much damage to yourself already. You wanted sort of a proactive play that could speed up the clock.
I did. So I was thinking that, you know, I'm already so low on life. Why not to put the Death Shadows in? And to make room for them, I took out the Snapcaster Mages because I felt like they were a little bit redundant with the Dreadhorde Arcanist. I kept the Young Pyromancers, so now my creature suite for this version, which was like a Grixis Shadow Arcanist, was the 4 Arcanists, the 4 Pyromancers, the 4 Death Shadows. And then I had to make room for Street Wraiths, so I don't remember what I cut for those. That deck played okay. Like, I went 2-3 when I took that Thorough League. All the matches were really close. I think that all 3 of the matches that I lost, I won game 1. And then lost all the sideboard games, which was a little bit troubling. But they were, you know, they were good fights against tier decks. It made me think that maybe, you know, I hadn't put that much thought into my sideboard, and I felt like the other decks I was playing against were getting better against me, and I wasn't really improving against them. So I wasn't that discouraged by the deck. Like, I thought it was okay, but it still sort of had that sort of random pile of Grixis cards feel to it, and that was especially true in a match I played against actual Grixis Shadow, where, you know, in matchups like that where it is about resources and trading resources, I kind of would have rather had a Snapcaster Mage that at least gets you a 2-for-1, whereas the Arcanist, being a sort of pseudo confidant, was getting picked off, and I didn't have any like clean tempo swings like a Gurmag Angler. I had sort of maybe tempo swings like a Death Shadow or a Pyromancer plus a token. So I kind of left that match feeling like maybe I just had a worse, clunkier version of Grixis Shadow on my hands. It was a lot, you know how they say about like Taco Bell, like there's only like 5 ingredients for all of Taco Bell's menu items. Whenever they unveil a new item, it's just the 5 ingredients combined in a totally new way. For like, this kind of felt like that for these decks. Like, I didn't feel like we had unlocked anything new. It was just sort of, the Arcanist was kind of swapping in for Snapcaster or whatever, or Confidant, but it wasn't doing it necessarily any better. There was some matches where it was okay, it was a little better, some matchups where it was a little bit worse, but it wasn't inspiring to me.
And then, Damon, you kind of combined sort of the two of them. I think you were going to sort of start building maybe a Jund list that used Death Shadow, but then you kind of moved away from that. So you want to talk about sort of your thought process there?
Yeah, basically, it seems like Arcanist works well with three angles of attack. One is the blue cantrips, two is the discard spells, and three is the Atarka's commands become immense pump blitz spells. And yeah, it sounded like from the testing that in Legacy, you play an Arcanist and Flashback of Brainstorm as your kind of like floor of the card, and all of a sudden you have a two mana Jace. That's what Jace does every turn, he brainstorms. Whereas like if Jace all he did was like Serum Visions, it would not be anywhere near as good of a card. And so maybe like the blue package just isn't quite as good in Modern for that reason. But then the discard package does still seem actually quite strong. You can really rip apart somebody's hand with it. And then the Atarka's Command interaction actually was pretty powerful in my matches. So I was wondering if we could kind of combine the best of both worlds. It turns out there's like a lot of tensions in the deck building, and so I couldn't figure out how to make the shadow part also work, but decided to basically try the black discard featuring around six discard spells, and then three Atarka's Commands and the Mutagenic Growth package, coupled with some of the Jund cheaper creatures like Grimflayer, Tarmogoyf, Monastery Swiftspear, to build an overall like lean, much leaner than traditional Jund, and much more of an aggressive deck than a kind of mid-range or even control deck. So that was the overall intention. And then we weren't sure, you know, there's like some cards that just felt interesting. So like Claim to Fame, which I think you guys also tried in the Grixis Shadow type lists. And then like a one of Faithless Looting seems to make any random brew better somehow, especially if the brew has any graveyard synergy.
Yeah, at the very least, it provides you a card to side out when you're not sure what to take out for your interaction.
Sure thing.
And I do think it has it's useful in lists like this where you're playing and flashing back a lot of removal. And then that means that, you know, in the late game, Inquisition or Thoughtseize is often a dead card. So you do Faithless Looting is effectively drawing you a card in those situations.
Yeah, no, I was happy with the Faithless Lootings. I played, I think, one or two in a couple of these shows. And I think partly because the game was just dragging on so long that I was starting to flood, even though I was ostensibly cards up. I just had more lands than I needed and was like hoping to draw Faithless Looting at some point just to clear away the chaff.
So, Dan, you ran this list that Damon's describing through a league this afternoon, was it?
Yeah, just before we recorded this call tonight. So,
all right, so this is fresh off the press. So you want to tell us a little bit about how it felt?
It felt really weird. You will be able to find this list in tomorrow's 5-0 dump. I would 5-0'd actually very, very easily. I didn't really understand how or why. I think I didn't lose a game until round 5. So I think I'm like 10-1 in games. It was kind of crazy. I didn't really understand what was happening. It kind of felt like I was getting a little bit lucky in the sense that I was often drawing cards and being like, oh yeah, this is useful in this matchup. But I wasn't expecting to draw these cards. I wasn't really sure if they were the plan or not. Everything worked pretty well. Like even the random stuff like Maximize Velocity. Like I had a game where unknown opponent, so game one, my hand is like a Young Pyromancer, which is a one of, a Maximize Velocity, which is a one of, and an Atarka's Command and like four lands. And so yeah, I just kept that just because I wanted to see what would happen. And it turned out to be like a racing matchup. So just like I drew a Thoughtseize at some point, cast that on turn 3, then cast the Maximize Velocity on the Pyromancer token, flashback the Velocity, just because like it was going to be a clean race, and like that ended up being the difference maker in the race. So who knows? I mean, it was really weird. It was really weird. One thing that I really liked about the deck was that, I love the Atarka's Command. That was amazing. So kudos to Damon for pushing us in that direction. I really liked how I had the option to have disruption in the form of discard and like black removal, which I didn't think I was going to like that because it's a little weird to go like Inquisition turn 1, Swift Spear turn 2 or something like that. But at the same time, when you find yourself in like a creature matchup or a combo matchup, like those are just like the cards that you need. Like I played against Amulet in this league and I won that match because I had these Thoughtseizes and Inquisitions. I played against a couple of creature-based decks, and I won those because I was able to slide in a bunch of Fatal Pushes and Collected Brutalities. You had Searing Blood in the sideboard, which I kept those. They were actually pretty good. I was very surprised to see them. Like, what was the reasoning behind those, just out of curiosity?
It feels like if you're playing in a creature deck that really wants to race, you know, like traditionally just like a red deck win style deck. Searing Blood is a really good creature removal spell because it affects the early creatures, which is when you're trying to make room for your creatures, and then it hits them in the face for 3, which is no joke. And of course, it doesn't hit Wormcoil Engine, but the goal of this deck is to not let them survive to cast Wormcoil Engine.
Yeah. I think it was wise to keep them in the board. I'm not sure I would play them again in the sideboard, but yeah, so the matchups that I played against were, I think I played against Tron, I played against Storm, I played against Amulet. And those were matchups where, like, you do need a little bit of disruption, but it's mainly about speed. But, like, against the Storm deck, I wouldn't have won if I hadn't had access to this removal. And then the creature matchups, it was some kind of Zoo deck and, like, a Merfolk deck. I really appreciated how, like, the Arcanist, which is kind of the linchpin of both strategies, like, is this massive threat when you're in the control role. And he was just amazing there as well. He was amazing in both sort of styles of game, both the racing games and the attrition games. So I felt like in that sense, I finally was like seeing his potential realized in a more complete way than we'd seen in the Grixis list, where he was just sort of chipping away for a cantrip and a point of damage. Like, I got to flashback a Turkish command a few times off him, but that was amazing. The card that I almost cut before I started the league was Mutagenic Growth, which he has a four of in the list. And I thought, like, well, this is just a little bit too, I don't know, too optimistic. I'm still not sure if that's any good, but I never had to, like, waste it. It was actually, it was pretty good. I'm begrudgingly admitting that it was pretty good. I'm still not sure I like the card. The other thing that you mentioned was that the Grimflayer Red Horde Arcanist, like, tag team is potentially synergistic. I never actually got that specific combo of, like, Grimflayer to mill something and then flashback with the Arcanist. But as you guys know, I've been high on Grimflayer for a long time, just as a general card. Like, I play him in my green-black rock decks. And, yeah, he was just continuing to be good as a general two-drop beater. Like, the fact that he becomes a 4-4 with Trample is suddenly very relevant when you're casting a Turkish command for 3 damage and +1/+1 to your team. Like, on those turns, which came up frequently, like, I was very happy that he wasn't just a confidant or something like that.
Yeah, one thing you guys will learn is that if you ever want Dan to try your list, you should just add 4 Grimflayer to it.
Yeah, flare it up. So, yeah, I think the takeaway I had from playing it was I wasn't totally sure. I'm sure the numbers were all wrong, but I kind of expected that at the end of the league, I would be ready to cut the black. I'd be like, oh, you know, the black is a little bit too schizophrenic in terms of whether we want to be casting discard and removal or whether we want to be casting pump spells. But I'm not sure I do. I think I want to keep the black. You could definitely build a much more streamlined Turkish command deck that had, you know, all the prowess creatures on one. A Tarmogoyf was quite good, so maybe Tarmogoyf and Arcanist on two. But yeah, then you'd give up a lot of the ability to interact with their hand and their board. So I don't know, maybe this is the sweet spot.
With a Tarkus command, though, Dan, did you feel the wanting more young Pyromancer? So you have more creatures that kind of absorb those +1/+1 counters, or Tarmogoyf was just so powerful you never felt that?
Yeah, I was pretty happy with it just as a 4 damage spell, like the 3 damage to their face and +1/+1. And sometimes it did more than that. So in that sense, like, yeah, it would have been nice to have more creatures. But playing more Pyromancer would mean giving up on either Grimflayer or Tarmogoyf. I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. Everything works so well.
Or the Ghoul Spellbreaker. There's a lot of one-offs in the list. Yeah,
that guy was good. He was really good. I don't know what to say. Yeah.
This is something that is part of my style for testing new decks. I like to add a lot of just one-offs. This is something I actually learned from Reed Duke a long time ago. He posted a video. Just it lets you try out different cards and see which ones really feel like they have a home in your deck. Clearly, you wouldn't want to take a deck to a tournament with this many one-ofs, but when you're refining a deck and tuning it, it helps to have it just for the variety. But yeah, there's definitely a tension in deck building with, like, Dreadhorde Arcanist, who wants you to have, like, a lot of spells, and Atarka's Commander wants you to have a lot of creatures, and so it's not actually clear how to balance these interests. This is actually the issue with Adelies, is that Adelies also wants you to have a lot of wizards in particular, and at some point you can only have your deck be doing so many things.
So it's possible that a Turkish command doesn't need you to have more than one creature. It needs you to be attacking, and if as long as you're attacking and have one creature, it's worth 4 damage, which is a Boros Charm, which is fine.
Yeah, it's true. And even with a single Arcanist, it still becomes a double Boros Charm, which is, like, more than fine. That's fair.
Yeah, but I wouldn't have known that until I played the game, so I don't know. I'm not sure. I can't give this deck a total endorsement yet, but it surprised me. It will surprise me, and there may be something there. I think I kind of want a couple more one drops, not the full set of Soulscar Mage, but maybe a couple more. Yeah, there's some tinkering to be done.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, do you want to be doing a one drop on turn one, or do you want to be doing a discard spell? How do you feel about that, Dan?
I felt happy that I had played a good chunk of Modern before, in the sense that I usually knew by their first land play, like, what matchup it was. So I think this is the kind of deck where if you weren't able to decide from, like, turn one whether you should just be, like, vomiting creatures onto the board or, like, holding your stuff, like, holding your interaction and conserving your life total with your fetch lands, like, you could just go astray. So I think because this deck can play two very distinct roles that prioritize very different things, yeah, the answer is going to vary a lot depending on what you're playing against and how quickly you identify, like, what matters in the matchup.
So yeah, it sounds like there's some promise in that list, tinkering to be done there. I think there's, you know, some options to be done on some of those other lists as well. But I mean, it seems like Arcanist is certainly a modern power level card. I mean, that seems like a reasonable conclusion to draw. The tensions that it kind of creates, still unresolved, maybe, despite our best efforts.
Yeah, it's close to modern playable. I think it definitely deserves a little bit more time being tried. I don't think we've, like, proven that it's, like, clearly modern, like a modern staple, but it's close.
Well, modern staple and modern playable are different things, so.
Sure. Still, even modern playable, where if you, like, show up at a tournament with Dreadheart Arcanist, people don't, like, you know, look at you funny. Or at least, like, look at the card and have to, like, read it.
So I feel like the card definitely, like, worth a little more exploration. I felt like there were, like, at least two or three avenues that seemed good. So I think the best one was the Atarka's Command, and I think there the takeaway I had was just that, like, you don't want to just be, like, blinking away for one damage at a time with this. Like, you want to use the fact that he can end the game quickly. So some kind of, like, more all-in Atarka's Command deck would be good. But the other direction that I thought was interesting was, you know, using him not just as a replacement for Confidant, but as, like, additional Confidants. And this is something that we didn't actually get to test, but I noticed, David, that you had proposed an update to your Grixis list where you actually had, I think, what, four Confidants and four Arcanists?
I think I had two or three Confidants and four Arcanists.
Well, maybe in my mind I upgraded that to four because I was like, ooh, you could have all the Confidants. Where I think, like, part of what I disliked about the Grixis shells that I was trying was that, like, you know, I felt like I just had the same basic ratios of stuff as before. But we actually have the ability now that I feel like Arcanist has proven his ability to be a Confidant type card. You can play four Confidants and four Arcanists now, and maybe we should try that. So in conjunction with, I think, the third takeaway I had was that Young Pyromancer is actually better than I thought. Like, maybe his time has come again. Like, you could have a deck built around those as your two drops, and maybe that's, like, something to just try it out and just assume that that will win.
Are you thinking you would play Jund, though? You still want to play Jund because you want access to the...
I'm not sure. I think that would be one way to do it, or the other way would be maybe, like, Mardu Pyromancer, something like that, with Lingering Souls, maybe a Monastery Mentor or a Seasoned Pyromancer, the new one. More of, like, a tokens strategy where, you know, again, like, if you have a lot of tokens, like, Haze of Rage is not totally crazy. It's a little crazy, but it's not totally crazy. I think, like, we just haven't seen a deck that tried to play eight Confidants before, because, you know, some players think that Confidant is too much of a liability to even play an entire playset. Arcanist does not have that problem, right? It gets better the more than you have, assuming your graveyard is still full. So yeah, I think there's still something there that we didn't have time to explore yet, but that's something I would be interested in.
So I think the one takeaway is you have to be doing damage faster. If you're playing a deck without counter magic, you need to get them dead in a reasonable time frame or you are going to lose. Modern decks are very powerful. You can't be going up 2/3 of a card every turn is not going to get the job done in this world anymore.
Sad but true.
Agreed.
All right, so this week we are going to talk about a card that Dan's been itching to brew around, and then I think next week we're going to start coming out with some of our Modern Horizons brews. So those are cards worth looking for. Now, the card that Dan is interested in talking about this week is Bolas's Citadel, and Dan, you've got a few kind of shells you're kind of proposing to get into play, and some of them do include cards from the new Modern Horizons, and as those come up, I'll just sort of let you discuss them. But do you want to first tell us what Bolas's Citadel does and why you are interested in brewing around it?
Well, you might have to call up the card in front of you and read its text, because when I think of it, I think of two things. I think it is a Yawgmoth's bargain stapled to a channel, but I know that's not the actual text. So if you have the actual text,
I have it up in front of me.
Okay. Right. Why don't you read the card first?
Citadel is 3BBB, so 6 total mana. Legendary artifact. You may look at the top card of your library anytime. You may play the top card of your library. If you cast a spell this way, pay life equal to its converted mana cost rather than pay its mana cost. And then you can tap it, sacrifice 10 non-land permanents. Each opponent loses 10 life. So it's sort of a card advantage engine strapped to sort of a win condition.
It's a card advantage engine strapped to a mana engine. Like, the fact that it wins the game is like incidental. I don't actually think that last line of text is mostly irrelevant. The sacrifice 10 permanents thing. It's like how I was saying last week that when you're thinking of Dreadhorde Arcanist, don't forget that it casts a spell for free. And like Damien, you were saying how important that is in Legacy. I think that's the key to Bolas the Citadel as well. Yeah, it's a big, expensive card advantage engine. There are plenty of those. And most of the time when people see them, they just, you know, they sort of laugh it off as, oh, some people will be tricked by this card. It's just a 6 mana do nothing or whatever. You know, do nothing being the sense that you pay a bunch of mana for this thing that, you know, will allow you to next turn do something cool after you untap with it. And those cards are basically dead in the water in Modern and even in Standard for the most part. You know, think of something like Thousand Year Storm or Primal Amulet. Those cards just don't do anything. Even Experimental Frenzy, which was a card that I thought was great for Modern, it had that do nothing problem. Like the turn you spend 4 mana to cast it, you don't get its ability yet. Like, unless you have a lot of zero drops or get very lucky. So those cards just aren't going to work, but Citadel does not have that problem. Citadel lets you start using it right away because, you know, it's providing the mana for you. In that sense, it's kind of like a Wilderness Reclamation, which is, it's not a do-nothing. You pay mana, you invest your mana in it, but you get the mana back immediately. So it's kind of like an engine with haste, if you'll allow that analogy. So that's why I think that Citadel is not... it doesn't fall prey to the same do-nothing dilemma that a lot of these engine cards do. But I don't know. What do you guys think of it? I've already said that I think it's Yawgmoth's Bargain plus Channel, two insanely broken cards. But is this a card that has been on your radar at all?
Damon, you first.
The card looks a little bit wacky to me. I mean, the problem is that Channel plus Yawgmoth's Bargain sounds cool, but sometimes you'd rather just like have the Yawgmoth's Bargain alone without the Channel. I guess the question I have is, can you reliably win with it in play? Like, as soon as it comes into play, you just win. And two is, as an artifact, it's susceptible to a lot of different forms of hate. So how do you, A, make sure you can get it into play unprotected? Or, I mean, how do you protect it to get into play? And then how do you keep it in play once it gets there? Because I'm assuming at the very least that if you design your deck to win with it in play, your deck will probably not win with it not in play. That could be wrong. It's possible you have like the valuable as a Citadel, but I suspect that doesn't work that way.
No, those are all great questions that I think every brewer, especially for these jankier combos, needs to be honest with themselves and sort of ask these questions. Like, so is it susceptible to artifact hate? Yes, it's susceptible to some kinds of hate. So it's not susceptible to Karn or Stony Silence in that it doesn't have an activated ability.
It does have an activated ability. You're choosing not to build to use it.
Right. I'm streamlining the card to improve the card.
Right. There it is.
Don't trick yourself into thinking that
putting
that's
some white
condition
out on the bottom line just to make it a little sleeker.
Right. So you should plan to win with something else. So it is vulnerable to Ancient Grudge and cards that destroy artifacts, provided that, you know, they have mana available. Right. So I think identifying these constraints, right? You'll feel really bad if you build your entire deck to get some card into play. You play it and they immediately destroy it and you get nothing. So I think that pushes me to answer your third question, Damon, of like, do you win right away? I think we should try to win right away because we don't want to like give them the chance to just remove the Citadel. But you don't have to win right away. I think that's another thing that intrigues me about this card is that when you think of a card like Yawgmoth's Bargain or Experimental Frenzy, even like they usually have some kind of drawback. Having this card in play will change the rules of Magic for you, like you no longer get a draw step or something like that. But Citadel doesn't actually have any drawbacks. Like there, it's just an additional thing you can do in addition to playing normal Magic. So you don't actually have to be all in on it. You can, like, for example, if you played a Citadel, activated a few times, like cast like three or four cards. Now you're just up three or four cards and a bunch of tempo. You're down some life. So maybe you didn't win the game yet, and maybe they destroy the Citadel, but like you still are ahead. So you don't necessarily have to be entirely all in on the card, but I think you might, you know, we might as well try to, just for the first go around, see if we can do it, to like not give them the chance to kill the Citadel.
Yeah, to me, I mean, echoing kind of what Damon is saying, we're going to, looking at these lists, we're not playing this for six mana. So we're bending a lot of cards, playing a lot of cards that don't really do anything without it in play to put it in play. So yeah, I think I would need it to win the game, the turn it comes into play, or certainly the next turn, a reasonable percentage of the time to make it worthwhile. And yeah, I don't have a lot of experience with a lot of the kind of shells you're proposing, so I can't say that they're bad or good. But I've kind of noodled around with how I would try to build around it, and I haven't really like resolved it in my own mind. So I'm kind of interested to walk through some of the shells that you've outlined for us.
Yeah, so I think before I get to the shells, which they're a little bit, they're a little rough around the edges, I think that we should at least talk through the different ways to get this card into play, because I think each one of those will suggest a different shell. I've made a running list of ways you can plausibly get this into play, and actually it became quite a long list. So I'm just going to throw some of these out there and maybe get your quick thoughts on sort of which of these are plausible. So the first one, the most enticing one, is the card Trash for Treasure. Two and a red sorcery, sacrifice an artifact to return an artifact from your graveyard to the battlefield. So it's kind of like a tinker, but it gets the card out of the graveyard. That card has been around since Mirrodin. Like, I think it is potentially broken, but for whatever reason, they don't print that many game-winning artifacts, or when they do, they give them a clause like Plightsteel Colossus, where they shuffle back in. But as the format gets bigger, Trash for Treasure gets more dangerous, and I think Bolas the Citadel is the kind of card that could end the game. So if the goal is to sort of reanimate the Citadel, then you could be thinking of a shell somewhat similar to a Goryeo's Vengeance type shell, where you're trying to like discard it, you know, Faithless Looting, that kind of thing, and then you have the rest of the deck built to win after you have it in play. There's another card, Refurbish, which is three and a white sorcery. That's just a clean reanimation for an artifact. So if you wanted to get it in play by putting it in the graveyard first, you have those two options. The second option is Lotus Bloom. In this scenario, you're just paying six mana for it, but you're cheating on that mana by suspending a Lotus Bloom, hopefully on turn one. It'll come into play on turn four, at which time you'll have, you know, your three lands. They don't even have to be black lands, because a Lotus Bloom provides a 3-black, so you can just cast it that way. Lotus Bloom, of course, is kind of awkward when you don't draw it on turn one, so there is another way to get it into play, and that is with Reshape or Whir of Invention. Both of those cards are blue. They search an artifact of CMCX directly into play. And since Lotus Bloom is CMC0, you can get the Lotus Bloom pretty cheaply. Reshape lets you get a Lotus Bloom for just the two blue, and Whir of Invention gets it for three. So I think there's some, like, a reasonable synergy between those. It just so happens that the wording on Bolas the Citadel allows you to cast these Time Spiral suspend zero cards for free off the top of your deck, so you don't get stuck if you hit a Lotus Bloom on top. You just put that into play with the Citadel. Should I keep going with this list, or do you guys want to chime in on those?
I kind of want to hear all the other ways that you're going to put this into play.
All right, I'll keep going. We proceed down the list of ways to put this into play. The next card is a kind of another forgotten card, Shape Anew. Do you guys know what Shape Anew does?
I do.
I have to pull this one up, to be honest.
This is another one that I honestly forgot was in Modern. There are a lot of these artifact cards that people just, at one point they knew about them, but I think artifact decks have been so focused on Affinity or KCI or something that we kind of forgot there was this other direction of artifact combo that you can do. So Shape Anew is like a polymorph, but for artifacts. So three and a blue sorcery, the controller of target artifact sacrifices it, then reveals cards from the top of their deck until they hit an artifact, put that into play. So in order to play that card, you can get any artifact out of your deck with that as long as that's the only artifact in your deck. So that means you need to have an artifact token, like a clue token, for example, or a treasure token, or something that becomes an artifact, such as like a Blink Moth Nexus, Or you can, you know, have an artifact with like Karn, the Great Creator, can pull an artifact out of your sideboard, and you can get your shape and your target that way.
Or the other four mana Karn just makes an artifact as well.
Correct, yeah. And Saheeli, Sublime Artificer, also makes artifact. There are a lot of cards that just sort of make things that happen to be artifacts, and the fact that artifacts hasn't mattered before, but that's because we haven't had much incentive to be casting Shape Anew on them before. So that is an avenue that I think is plausible.
Play a Madcap Experiment if you want a 4-mana sorcery with that deck building constraint.
It's like you're looking at the same list that I'm looking at, Damon. That's amazing, because that's the next card on my list.
I'm not. What? Okay. Well, maybe I should be looking at the list.
So, Madcap Experiment, can you tell us what that does, Damon?
Well, think about Shape Anew, but not requiring you to sacrifice an artifact. Madcap Experiment is 3 and a red for a sorcery. Reveal cards from the top of your library until you reveal an artifact. Put it onto the battlefield. Oh, it does damage 2 equal to the number of cards. I forgot about that clause.
Oh, I thought you were joking.
The reason I forgot about that clause is because usually you combine Madcap Experiment with either Platinum Empyrean or Platinum Angel, both of which make it so taking damage is completely irrelevant. That's like a combo that occasionally sees play in modern decks, either like as a transformational sideboard option or in some like Jeskai Can't Lose type shell that hopes to just make one of those guys indestructible with Chance for Glory. But okay, that might be a pretty big downside with a Bolas of Citadel.
Well, it is and it isn't. So I think that what I find is super interesting about that constraint of losing life or taking damage is that the Citadel is also constrained by life. So the Citadel is already incentivizing you to put life gain in your deck so that you know, life is now a resource, right? So you kind of want cards that gain life. Children of Corliss is very interesting in that kind of deck, or just anything that gains life, which supports both the Citadel and the Madcap Experiment at the same time. So I think it's not crazy, but I think the other big constraint is that both Shape Anew and Madcap Experiment mean that you can only put the Citadel as, that can be the only artifact in your deck. Which is a little annoying because one of the cleanest kill conditions with Citadel is the card Aetherflux Reservoir from Kaladesh. You know, it's a commander favorite. It gains you an increasing amount of life every time you cast a spell. And then once you've got 50 life, you can shoot the opponent for 50. So that is probably the easiest way to like convert a Citadel into an immediate kill. But because it's an artifact, you probably can't put it in the same deck as a Shape Anew Madcap Experiment deck. So you have to find a different kill condition. If you're going to do that.
If your kill wins 80% of the time, I guess that's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, it's not crazy. Like, I'm willing to try it. Okay, let me continue down the list, and then we'll see if we have any more enticing options. So the next card that cheats an artifact into play is Kuldotha Forge Master. So this is a weird one that's probably bad. It's a 3/5 artifact creature that allows you to tap, sacrifice, I think any 3 artifacts, is that right?
Yep, you can sacrifice it itself as well.
Yeah, to tutor an artifact into play. So that is probably too fragile because you have to play the Forge Master first, which is, you know, at 5 mana, that's only 1 fewer than the Citadel itself. Then it has to survive or gain haste somehow to activate its ability. But 5 generic mana is easier than 3 black, black, black. You can cheat it into play off a number of things. So like if you're thinking of a deck that has Grand Architect or Ethereum Sculptor, something like that, like a blue steel deck like Zach Elsick used to play, a Forge Master is not that hard to cast in that deck and can then grab the Citadel or whatever else you need. So those are the cards that I identified as ones that sort of cheat the Citadel into play. There is also just various mana ramp. I listed a few cards that are particularly good at ramping out Citadel, but before I get into those, I just want to mention that 3 black by black is not totally impossible. People told me that you can't cast Nid-Mizzet Reborn because 5 mana is impossible in Modern. I don't take impossible for an answer. You know, it's not a do-nothing. Yes, it takes some work, but you can just play it for 6 mana. How you get to 6 mana and on what turn, like, well, that's up to you. So the cards that I think are interesting for ramping into Citadel are Grand Architect, which I just mentioned. That's a blue-blue 1/3 creature that allows you to tap any blue creature for 2 mana that can only be used on artifacts. And that has already seen some amount of play. I won't call it success, but it has seen some fun play in Zach Elsick's blue steel deck. That deck incentivizes you to play a lot of cheap blue creatures, some of which can synergize with artifacts. like the chief engineer or the Ethereum sculptor. So chief engineer is another one that we should talk about here. It's a 1/3, gives all of your artifacts convoke, so you can now use your creatures to produce mana for artifacts. And we have a new one that works in a similar space. That's Urza, Lord High Artificer from Modern Horizons. I don't actually remember all the text on that card, but I know that one of his abilities is to allow you to tap any artifact you have for blue mana. It's basically a Tolarian Academy. So he generates stunning amounts of mana himself. So those three are just blue creatures that happen to produce a lot of mana for artifacts. Other ways to get the mana, Nykthos Shrine to Nyx can add a bunch of mana if you're in like a black devotion type shell. And two cards that I think are particularly interesting are Renegade Rallier and Sakura Tribe Elder, both because they can ramp you. So the Rallier can ramp you if you're playing fetch lands, and Sakura Tribe just sacks to get a land into play. They both have useful abilities in conjunction with the Citadel, in the sense that, like, yeah, you want to have the ability to shuffle your deck when you have something unfortunate stuck on top. So you want fetch lands if you're in like a maybe like a green white, either Naya or Abzan Citadel shell. The Rallier can also get back a creature like a Children of Corlys, if that's going to be your way to gain your life back. And we can mention Path to Exile here as well. You know, you're not supposed to use that on your own creatures, but if you need to ramp, yeah, you can do so. So I think that there's actually a ton of different ways to just generate six mana or build a shell that can plausibly just cast this for six. Okay, so I've been rambling and raving about how to generate three black and three generic. What do you guys think of these options?
I don't hate the idea of Trash for Treasure. I actually think that card is very powerful, and I do agree it just hasn't found the right shell yet. It is vulnerable to graveyard hate, and Bolas the Citadel, or the card you're sacrificing for to Trash for Treasure, are artifacts. So the two kind of common sideboard hate cards that people always pack answers for in their sideboard, we'll be targeting these, but that's something we can kind of work around. But that's the most promising to me, and I guess the second most promising is the Shape Anew plan, because that leaves a lot of extra slots where we can work on our like win. I'm not as into like ramping into it and then getting to play a bunch of ramp cards now that I've got my 6-mana artifact in play that costs 2 mana to play Sakura, or 2 life to play Sakura Tribe Elder off the top of my deck. That's not doing it for me. What do you think, Damon?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that whenever I'm thinking through a modern sideboard, usually I think I want at least 3 anti-artifact cards and at least 4 anti-graveyard cards. So that is an issue. The other issue also is just kind of counter magic. Blue-white control is pretty popular these days, and getting any number of these cards Dovin's vetoed would be bad news. So somehow, like, hard casting it or maybe like War of Invention being an instant. War of Invention requires a lot of deck building like constraints, though. Well, you have to usually play a lot of artifacts. At least, I guess you don't have to, but...
Yeah, but I mean, we've seen successful decks that feature this as a 4-of, like both Lantern and War Prison. It's even named after War of Invention, so that's not crazy. I mean, that's a constraint, sure. You know, any build around is going to have constraints like this. This is kind of like the opposite of Dread Horrorness. Like, this card needs a lot of love and TLC to get into play. But your point about counter magic is well taken.
And Trash for Treasure does sacrifice the artifact as part of its cost, to Damon's point. So you are getting 2-for-1 if it gets countered.
So I think that earlier, Damon, I didn't address this question before, but you'd raise the question of, like, are you entirely all in on this? Like, what happens if you don't have it? And yeah, or what happens if you go for it, they counter it? Are you just dead in the water? I think a lot of decks fall apart. They just can't pass this test. So I think the best version of a Bolas the Citadel deck will be one that doesn't need this card to win. Like, it's like a powerful A plan or a powerful B plan, but it has to have a secondary plan that doesn't require you to resolve this, so that you don't just fold to a Surgical Extraction or whatever, or one counterspell.
So, or you just play a 4 Teferi Time Raveler and he's a whole Narset set.
He is in one of the lists I'm about to propose to you. But yeah, let's dive into the sketches then, because I think we've identified a lot of possible ways you can go, but we've also talked about a lot of road hazards, things that could just lead you astray or prove to be insolvable problems. So the first sketch that I want to talk about, I'm calling this the Turbo Citadel sketch, is built around Trash for Treasure, because that is the fastest way to get this into play. So I And using the core of the deck is a lot of cheap artifacts that I'm borrowing from the deck Lantern Control. So I think that what I find really, really promising about the Lantern Control shell is a little trick that I learned from when I was wasting a lot of time with Experimental Frenzy, is that when you're trying to go off, you need to be able to change the top card of your deck so you don't just get stuck when there's something uncastable there or when there's two lands. It just so happens that the cards Codex Shredder and Gulp Color's Bell can change the top card of your deck. Now, you usually see those used to change the top card of the opponent's deck in the Lantern Control shell, but incidentally, they can mill you. Milling you also finds the Bolas of Citadel, puts it in the graveyard so that you can get it with a trash for treasure. And then once you have the Citadel in play, you basically go through your entire deck at once for as much life as you have, because so every time you cast like another Shredder or Ghoul Caller's Bell or even a Lantern, which has a shuffle effect, like you can just sort of stash those mills in play, and then anytime you hit a land, you just mill it away. You just keep going until you find your Aetherflux Reservoir and win that turn. So the deck is mostly those artifacts. And to complete the picture, you have Mox Opals, Ensnaring Bridge. That's sort of the only way that Lantern stays alive. And Ancient Stirrings to sort of hold it all together. So that basically what I've described so far is just the Lantern Control shell. And to that, we add the Bolas of Citadel package of 4 Faithless Looting, 4 Trash for Treasure, 4 Citadel, and 1 Aetherflux Reservoir.
So once you have the Citadel in play, the goal is to just play a bunch of cheap artifacts, mill away any lands you hit, and then find your Aetherflux Reservoir, cross fingers it is in the bottom card in your deck.
Yeah, so there are two ways to do it. So one is that you find the reservoir. You go until you find the reservoir. In that case, you win immediately. The other way is to get the virtual kill of Ensnaring Bridge plus Lantern plus 2 Mill Rocks. That is a virtual kill against most of the format. You don't actually have to keep going once you have those in play. Like, people just cannot break that. So you don't have to, like, spend all your life trying to find the reservoir. You can do that, but if you feel like you're getting low on life and you haven't found it yet, you might just want to stop, sit back under your bridge, and then you become a Lantern Control deck from there, and the game is functionally over. So I think the reason why I'm optimistic about this deck is because it doesn't actually need the Citadel plan to even work. You're just a Lantern Control deck that happens to have the ability to win on turn 2. All you need is an Opal, 2 lands, Faithless Looting, Trash for Treasure. And if you draw on the Citadel, like, that's a kill.
Okay, that sounds pretty promising. What's your plan against counter magic? Is that traditionally a good matchup for the kind of Lantern decks? I would imagine it is not, but I'm not sure.
Well, I have no idea. It would probably involve siding out the Citadel, but I don't actually know. You need to ask a Lantern player about that, or I would need to ask. So yeah, so I think this is my first sketch because it is the most all-in. It doesn't have a backup plan apart from just like getting there with the Lantern Insight. It doesn't have a way. It doesn't have the discard package that you will find in real Lantern decks.
I mean, even if you just have like a bad blue-white matchup, that's not the end of the world. I mean, plenty of decks don't have positive matchups against every tier one modern deck.
True. So, I mean, I think that's what makes Modern so much fun to brew in, is that even if you can name 3 matchups that are unwinnable, like, that doesn't mean you're going to face those in a given tournament. So, yeah, I think this list might be too all-in to sort of feel really good about as the best build. But let me then transition to the second sketch, which is kind of an update to this.
I like the updated list that you're about to propose quite a bit more. So.
Okay, so the difference in this updated list, which I'm calling the Citadel Engineering sketch, is that it uses the new card Goblin Engineer from Modern Horizons. Do you have that in front of you by any chance, Dave?
Yes. Goblin Engineer, 1 and a red for a 1/2 Goblin Artificer. When it enters the battlefield, you may search your library for an artifact card, put it into your graveyard, and then shuffle your library. And then it has a text of red mana, tap it, sack an artifact, colon, return target artifact with converted mana cost 3 or less from your graveyard to the battlefield. This is a new card in Modern Horizons. It is a callback to a classic from our youth, from Urza's block. Sort of fixed. I think they tried to reprint cards with similar abilities that they tweaked out to not be quite so broken.
Yeah, it's a callback to Goblin Welder, but yeah, it's got an Entomb staple to it for some reason. So it's almost like a Stoneforge Mystic in that sense.
Yeah, I think it's a combination Goblin Welder, Stoneforge Mystic.
Damon is cringing now because he plays with actual Stoneforge Mystic in Legacy.
I mean, it's not a Stoneforge Mystic, but it does look pretty good to me. Nothing Stoneforge Mystic.
Okay, so there's a lot of chatter about this card right now because it's very exciting. And I think that the second ability is a trap in the sense that it the second ability of, you know, pay a red, tap, sacrifice an artifact, really, really cool ability, but that requires the engineer to stay alive, and you can't do it till next turn. So you don't want to be all in on the engineer surviving. So this build that I've sketched out here is interested mainly in the entomb, the first part of the card. You know, just search your library for an artifact, put that in the graveyard. So it's actually very, very similar to the previous list, except that instead of playing four Bolas of Citadel and four Faithless Leadings to try to like naturally draw it and discard it, we just play four Goblin Engineer. Now we only need to play one Citadel, because, you know, you only need one. The Engineer will find it, and then you still have your Treasure Treasures to get out of the graveyard then. So it's really slimmed down on the amount of space that is devoted to the combo kill. We just have one Reservoir and one Citadel. And that means we have a lot more space to be like a real Lantern Control deck. And that is, when I say real, I mean a deck that has four Inquisition and two Thoughtseize, in addition to the package of Lantern, Codex Shredder, Gulhola's Bell, and Ensnaring Bridge that we talked about in the previous show. What I think, one place that I cheated in this list is that I cut the Ancient Stirrings, because I was concerned about having to make both red and black mana. Maybe I should just not be so worried about that and put the Ancient Stirrings back in, because I might have too few lands without them. But, you know, there are some flex slots. I mean, I have two Faithless Lootings in here that actually don't serve much of a purpose. Like, I'm not actually planning to draw the Citadel. So I just have kind of two emergency lootings in case I happen to draw it. But you can always just Thoughtseize yourself if that comes up.
Yeah, I like this list quite a bit more. I don't like having to play multiple Bolas of Citadels, because it also means that Bolas Citadel can see itself some amount of the time. And if you are low on life, which does happen in a deck that doesn't have the most interaction in the world, it can be a lock on the top of your deck. I like Goblin Engineer just as a tutor. I think tutoring effects obviously are really powerful. I think we should consider adding the 4-mana Karn to this deck, since it can return the Bolas Citadel to your hand if it gets exiled, and it can win the game by itself. It should at least be in the sideboard.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like, all of these artifact-based decks now have to consider whether they should just be using Karn as a way to find the artifact. I think the reason that he's not at his best here is because putting the Citadel into your hand means that you have to play a lot of discard outlets or play a lot of mana, which this shell that I've drawn up does not do that. It's actually can't really make 6 mana. It's not playing Lotus Blooms. It's only playing 18 lands plus Opals. So I wouldn't be optimistic that even if I could cast the Karn, I could then actually cast the Citadel.
I mean, the problem is just that playing Surgical Extraction is a thing that people do, so the chances that Bolas of Citadel stays in your graveyard long enough for you to trash or treasure for it in games 2 and 3 is going to be reduced significantly.
Well, yes, but that is a concern I would have if I were not on a Lantern Control Plan A. So, like, the Bolas of Citadel is like the B plan. Like, I think most of the time I would be on the Lantern plan for until I knew the coast was clear. And I think that having these 6 discard spells allows me to sort of know what I'm up against within the first few turns, like to know whether my engineer should just search for an Ensnaring Bridge first, or whether like the coast is clear to search for the Citadel and try to trash for treasure it. But I don't know, we'll have to see if that actually works out. Maybe it's just like a worse Lantern deck, I'm not sure.
Yeah, the deck looks interesting to me. I mean, I do wonder if it's best to start with the super like hyperlinear version and then figure out the weak points and then build in defensive mechanisms. But it does make sense that adding in a bunch of discard spells makes you able to do this more reliably. And Goblin Engineer seems pretty good in the sense that you can also throw in like a random, yeah, you have like a Nihil Spellbomb in the list. If you're up against Dredge, you can just go Nuclear Graveyard. Or against Control, you can even go for like Hope of Ghirapur or something.
Hope of Ghirapur. Defense grade is legal, isn't it?
I don't believe so.
Maybe. I mean, Hope of Ghirapur, she's playing Legacy Storm.
All right.
Defense Grid was reprinted in 8th, so it is legal.
I've seen it in, like, some random sideboards.
There you go.
But, I mean, yeah, people have never really been on counter spells enough to, like, make it necessary. And I don't know, maybe counter magic is not the problem. Maybe it's that little Teferi that balances artifacts is the problem. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, also, playing 26 artifacts that all mostly have activated abilities against Karn is at least a little scary. But
I agree. So I think that is a problem, but I think that's also a motivation to try this list instead of just like giving up on Lantern as an archetype. I don't know this for sure. Disclaimer, I have not played much Lantern. But I think that one problem you could find as a Lantern player is that if the metagame is hostile to Lantern with a lot of Stony Silence effects or Ancient Grudges, or you have to fight through their entire 75 to win. With the Citadel combo, you no longer have to do that. You have the option to just kill them quickly, like before they draw their, you know, their hate cards. Maybe you can mill away the first one or something, or Thalsi's the first one, then kill them with a Citadel combo before they draw the second one. So it adds velocity to the deck.
I mean, I am intrigued. These lists have me curious to see how they actually operate in the real world. So I guess that's a commendable state of affairs.
Oh, man. So a bit of healthy skepticism for the first couple lists. The lists only get worse from here. So let's go to the next one. So the next one I'm calling Blue Lantern is using the Reshape plus Lotus Bloom interaction that I was talking about earlier, where here I'm not trying to use Trash for Treasure, because that creates all kinds of problems, or not problems, but complications, right? It requires me to put the artifact in the graveyard, I have to find it first, and then it's vulnerable to Surgical Extraction or whatever. So if I can just make 6 mana in a timely fashion, all I have to do is draw the Citadel. And the easiest way to make 6 mana is with Lotus Bloom. So I have 4 Lotus Bloom and 4 Reshapes to find it, which means that either if I have it in my opening hand, or if I draw Reshape and cast it on turn 2, by either turn 3 or turn 4, I'll have the ability to make 6 mana for the Citadel. I think the trade-off for that is that I now need to draw the Citadel naturally, so I'm playing 3 Citadels in the main deck, plus 4 Karn the Great Creator to fetch a 4th one out of the sideboard. That's 19 slots with the Lotus Blooms. The rest of the slots go almost entirely to that same Lantern package that we were talking about. The only card that's different, so I have the Codex Shredders, the Ghoul-Colored Bells, the Lantern of Insight, and the Ensnaring Bridge. I think that's the core of the Lantern deck. I'm adding Chromatic Stars because you do want to have something that you can sacrifice to a Reshape and not feel too bad about it. And it just so happens that the Chromatic Star allows you to change the top card of your deck when you're going off with a Citadel, provided that you have a spare mana, so like a Mox Opal. You can sort of stash draw effects with the Chromatic Star. Then the last card in the deck is Serum Visions. I kind of forgot about Serum Visions because I was so focused on changing the top card of my deck in the same way that Experimental Frenzy does. And in Experimental Frenzy, you know, cantrips don't really help you. They just waste your mana because cards in your hand don't help you. But it turns out that Citadel has no drawback like that. So if you cast a Serum Visions with a Citadel in play, that's great. You know, you drew a card, you scryed 2. You can still use cards you drew. So Serum Visions is an excellent card for a Citadel deck. So I just put 4 in to see what happens. Possibly that should just be Ancient Stirrings, or I should find room for Stirrings. I'm not sure. So thoughts on this shell, guys?
No, the mana base looks a lot more stable. And playing blue, you could, in theory, jam like stack protection against like Surgical. You use like Flusterstorm or something as soon as Modern Horizons is released. Karn the Great Creator will just win games on his own. I would guess that about half the games of this deck that you win will be because of Karn just steamrolling. It won't surprise me at all.
I'm fine with that. I think that I'm not trying to sell you or the listeners on the idea that, you know, Citadel is the be-all end-all, that you have to win with the Citadel. I think it's important to have multiple avenues to victory. And here you have 3 avenues. You have the Ensnaring Bridge Lantern plan. You have the Karn plan, which, you know, with Lotus Bloom, you can go Karn into Lattice pretty quickly. And then you have the Citadel plan. So you have 3 plans of attack, which is nice. Unfortunately, they're all artifact-based, but they don't require the graveyard. What you give up instead is you don't have counter magic or discard in the main deck. You're just hoping that Bridge keeps you alive until you've got your win off.
Yeah. Have you managed to goldfish this at all? Like, I'm curious, when you go for the Citadel line, how low you have to go with your life total before you can find your either Flux Reservoir?
So I have not goldfish. Well, okay, so that's a question that goldfishing cannot really tell you, because you won't know how much life you have to work with until you know like what matchup you're against. I will say that like once the Citadel is in play, you'll want to cast as many Ghoul-Colored Bells, Codex Shredders, and Chromatic Stars as you can, because those are just 1 mana each. Reshape is only 2 mana. Each Reshape that you find, you know, X has to be 0 when you cast it with a Citadel, but that can still find a Lotus Bloom. So you will sort of be able to cast a good amount of stuff and like have mana.
Even when you cast Reshape with Bolas the Citadel, you still have to sacrifice an artifact, correct?
You do, yeah. But that's okay. You'll have so many resources at that point.
Sure. You'll have all kinds of Codex Shredders to sacrifice.
Exactly. And yes, and again, like the earlier point about you don't need to find the Reservoir. You need to find Lantern, Bridge, and 2 Mill Rocks. And if you happen to find the Reservoir, like you did it, you know, you win. But possibly you just don't even need that in the deck. Like you can just put that in the sideboard for Karn to find if you want to.
Oh, actually, yeah, I like that a lot, actually. You just save a mainboard slot. What's the point of even having it main deck then?
Well, I mean, if you're not on Karn, if you're just on Citadel, you might want the ability to
reshape
for it. Mm. I don't know. So this is something that, yeah, we'll have to test. Like, there's a lot to learn about this through testing, but let's keep trucking along. I got one more that I'm interested in.
I have two more.
Okay, so the next one is a little bit different. So it's a white-based creature deck that happens to generate artifact tokens via Thraben Inspector and Blade Splicer. Artifact tokens allow you to cast Shape anew. That's the artifact polymorph that we talked about for 3 and a blue. That the only artifact in the deck is Bolas of Citadel. So my list starts with the 4 Thraben Inspectors, and in order to find them, right, that's not quite enough. We have this new card from Modern Horizons that I think is super promising for this show, Ranger Captain of Eos. Not Ranger of Eos and not Knight Captain of Eos, but Ranger Captain of Eos. 1 white for a 3/3. When it enters the battlefield, search your library for a creature card with converted mana cost, 1 or less, reveal it, put it in your hand. So that gets the Inspector, which we need to cast Shape anew. It also conveniently gets Children of Corliss, which is a card that I talked about for getting your life back so you can keep going. So that's already like a very, very handy card that is sort of more or less on curve with Shape anew. It's not totally on curve because you play it on 3, you still have to cast your Thraben Inspector and then play Shape anew. So it's not perfect. I haven't quite worked out how that mana sequence works yet. But it just so happens that Ranger Captain has this second ability that I hope will satisfy you, Damon, because you were concerned about Dovin's Veto. So it says, sacrifice Ranger Captain of Eos. Your opponents can't cast non-creature spells this turn. And I think a lot of people who are excited about this card in like creature decks are like, oh, this can stave off a Wrath for a turn. I'm like, yeah, maybe. I'm not too interested in that, but I'm interested in comboing off by using the secondary ability. They may not value the Ranger Captain that much. So if they let me untap with it, I'll just sack it. Now they can't counter my thing, I'll cast Shape anew and go off that turn, hopefully.
So one of my questions, Dan, I do like the shell, and I agree that this Ranger Captain of EL seems to be like really nice glue to hold the whole deck together. But, I mean, how are we winning? We don't have any of your sort of combo pieces in here. So once we have Bolas of Citadel in play, how do you imagine the rest of the game proceeding?
Yeah,
at that point?
So I was hoping you guys could answer that for me. I couldn't think of a kill condition. So the constraint here is that because of Shape anew, the kill condition cannot be an artifact because that interferes with the Shape anew. So you need something else, and I just didn't put one in because I couldn't think of it, but it must exist. There's got to be something.
Interesting. I mean, does Children of Corliss let you effectively go infinite somehow?
You play like Unearth in this deck.
I mean, I would be open to splashing Renegade Rallier and Secure Tribuilder. Because I think we're a little slow, and the Renegade Rallier gets a fetch land back, gets a Children of Corliss back. It's a handy card. Like right now I'm instead splashing black for a hidden stockpile to just generate more artifact tokens. And that's like a handy card because the Scry 1 ability is very useful for going off with the Citadel. But it's maybe not the right card. So yeah, we need a kill condition and we need to figure out like the early mana, I think.
Yeah, so just for reference, there's this deck called Tinfins in Legacy, and it's built around the interaction between Children of Corliss and Gristlebrand. There's many ways to win with a Gristlebrand in play, one of many. And Children of Corliss lets you, let's just say, pay 14 life to draw 14 cards, and then you sack Children of Corliss to gain back the 14 life. And then you draw 14 more cards, hopefully you've drawn another Children of Corliss. Now this one gives you 28 life. And so you effectively get to draw your whole deck, reliably, I think. And then you can win with any number of cards from there, such as Laboratory Maniac being one of them. Or possibly, honestly, like you could just play Empty the Warrens or Grapeshot.
Well, actually, of those that you mentioned, I think Laboratory Maniac intrigues me because it wins immediately. Empty the Warrens requires you to untap. I guess Grapeshot also wins immediately.
I mean, Labman has a nice alternate win condition of 2-2 beats. That should be ever happen, I guess.
I mean, is there a way we can do like 10 damage? And like, you could play Bolas of Citadel and the second Bolas of Citadel, they can each do 10.
You could. If I added like a third Citadel, you could kill them that way. Right, so the way you do that, you have a Bolas of Citadel in play, and there's one on top of your deck. You cast the one from the top of your deck, hold priority, and then with that priority, you activate the first Citadel or whatever. You don't want to like just cast the legend roll will kill the first Citadel immediately. But it can be done if you have enough permanence. Non-land permanence, which is a little bit tricky.
I think at the point that you're going infinite with Children of Corliss, like what's one extra permanent between friends? If you just use it first and then cast the new one, you can just sack 10 other permanents. But that is a good trick if you're right in the brink of 10 permanents.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing I don't like about Lab Maniac is, like, you don't want to be a deck that's just, like, all in on this and can't win otherwise. And Lab Maniac is basically dead. So, I mean, I'm sort of wondering if this deck can just be, like, a value Citadel, value combo Citadel, where, like, you get the Citadel and you just spew a bunch of resources into play. You don't have to kill them.
I mean, if you knew that one of the things you're going to be vomiting to play is a Teferi Time Raveler.
Okay, and that's fine.
I mean, generally speaking, I'm assuming that, you know, once you've managed to resolve your bowl as a Citadel, at the point that you can resolve a Shape Anew, I'm sure you can resolve a Lab Man. It was just instant speed creature kill. And if you can resolve a Shape Anew, I'm sure you can resolve a Teferi. And then that should be lights out. So I do wonder, how do you build this to be a reliable infinite combo with the Children of Corliss? Like, is two of them enough in the deck? Do you need a full four? This is a type of shell I just really have no knowledge of.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this. So I don't know. I think this one is the one where I think I understand how to get the Citadel into play, but I don't quite understand how to win. And I don't understand the mana requirements. Like, if you draw the Lab Maniac naturally, you're kind of screwed, because then you can't, like, you need to find a turn to cast it. This deck doesn't generate any extra mana. Like, there's no Opals or Lotus Blooms to, like, go up mana while you're comboing off. And the only way to, like, keep going is either with a fetch land or with, I put two Endless Horizons in the deck, which is a little bit of Colony Woods tech. He was screwing around with this card in a Citadel list earlier. Endless Horizons is 4 mana, lets you pull all the planes out of your deck and put them under the horizons. So if your mana base were entirely planes, you could, in theory, make it so there's no longer any lands in your deck with the horizons. So that would, like, let you keep going, but that would work if you did not naturally draw the Lab Maniac.
I'm intrigued. I mean, I like the shell. I like the fundamental plan more than the other ones. It seems better able to protect itself. It seems more like the plan B is that you just kind of play some creatures and stuff. Like, even in your fail case, you'll have dumped, presumably, you know, 3 Thraben Inspectors, a couple Blade Splicers onto the battlefield.
At the cost of...
For Ranger Captain of Eosis, I don't know. That's you know, I mean, pretty good amount of power.
It didn't cost you any mana. You went up cards. It just cost you some life. Maybe you got it all back with the children. It's not that bad.
No, with the children, there's a good chance that you have, like, way more life than you
started
with.
More life, yeah. I do think you want to play more children so you can do what Damon's describing, where you kind of go up throughout the course of your combo and get functionally infinite life.
Well, let's play some Ralliers then. I think that's even better because that helps us with ramp, which is a problem. Let's forget the Stockpile.
Stockpile and Wall of Omens and Declaration in Stone all seem unnecessary.
Yeah, okay, so I'm happy to cut those. So, yeah, and I think the other thing, like the sort of secondary angle of attack for a deck like this is, well, okay, there's like Anemic Creature Beats, which I'm not too excited about, but the presence of Teferi, you can Shape Anew for a Knowledge Pool if you swap out the Citadels for Knowledge Pool, which is its own hardlock. I think we talked about that a couple weeks ago. So, like, everything that I'm...
Oh, yeah, that sounds way better. Wow. That's an awesome deck. I love that idea.
Everything that I've put in this deck...
We don't have Endless Horizons anymore? This sounds amazing. Like, how do we do that?
Well, you take out the Citadel, you take out the Endless Horizons, you put in more Teferis, maybe a couple of Ineos, and a couple Knowledge Pools, and you have a deck.
This deck sounds awesome.
Okay, so maybe that's, like, yeah, we can test both.
We don't have to play Blinkmoth Nexus in our...
Okay, so that requires you to protect the Teferi, though, which is... Who knows if you can do that. You should still play Blinkmoth. That's, like, a easy artifact to include.
Fair.
For the Shape
Anew. But then we don't have to play Children of Corliss either, right? Because...
True. Okay, so one more list, then, just to round out this discussion. This last list I'm calling Blue Steel Citadel, and this is based off that Zach Elsick list from... I don't know, a year and a half ago or something like that. It's a Grand Architect deck. So that means that it's trying to play blue creatures that have some kind of artifact synergy on turns 1, 2, and 3. So that means on turn 1, you're looking at Mausoleum Wanderer. Turn 2, maybe Chief Engineer or Ethereum Sculptor, right? These are cards that either reduce the cost of artifacts or allow your creatures to cast artifacts. And then you have Grand Architect on 3 to get a ton of mana. Okay, so what artifacts are you going to cast? Any Grand Architect deck has this problem where you kind of want, like, a big payoff for the Grand Architect, like a big mana sink. But generally, if you don't draw the Architect, you could just never cast that card, and it's kind of a deck-building problem. So the solution that I'm hoping will work is to just play Karn the Great Creator instead. So I have, as sort of my big cards, I have four Karn and I have three Treasure Mage, which can search for any six EMC artifact or higher that's in your main deck. So like these cards will fetch up whatever I can cast with whatever mana creatures I happen to have down on the battlefield at the time. So the supplemental creatures that I have included to sort of round out the curve are Vault Scourge and Contraband Kingpin. These are kind of weird ones. They both have lifelink, but they're black creatures for Convoke, so they allow you to convoke the Citadel in play with the help of something like an Urborg or the blue-black filter land, maybe. And they are good with Cranial Plating. So that's sort of my beatdown package, is this a random blue/artifact creature beatdown. And then incidentally, I might have some mana that I could spend on a big artifact that locks up the game. So this is a little more of a, I don't know, maybe a little more casual fun list. I'm not sure how competitive it is, but I'm curious to hear your guys' thoughts on this.
So I actually think the idea of adding Karn the Great Creator to the blue steel citadel like shell is really powerful. I don't want to use it to do anything with Bolas the Citadel, but I had never occurred to me before, but yeah, it's like a way to turn all your mana into something. That actually seems really, really cool to me. So I'd be interested in maybe experimenting with like a few more trinket mages so you can fetch the XX that gets +1/+1 counters that you can fire off with Karn, and like a bunch of sideboard hate and stuff so that the deck sort of turns into an aggro deck that also has a bunch of game against other decks. I'm not sure what Bolas of Citadel does enough in this deck to sort of justify really bending the mana and stuff like that, but I really like the idea, and the more I think about it, of adding Karn the Great Creator to the shell.
Something just seems a bit strange to me in this deck, in the sense that there's like a lot of mana ramp, and then like not that much to ramp into, and then like the four Karn the Great Creator, you can't even use your Grand Architect to help cast, nor can you use your Ethereum Sculptor. Yeah, and then you still can't cast your Bolas of Citadel because of the triple black requirement. So like, it's not quite clicking for me. Like, what is the purpose of Ethereum Sculptor?
He used to have a purpose. He's a blue creature. I mean, I often wonder that about the original blue steel. Okay, so this may be a case where, as I'm pursuing these different possibilities, you know, you stumble upon a different artifact package that maybe is better suited to casting different artifacts. So it's possible that like trying to cast a 3 black-black-black artifact is just like not worthwhile. But I mean, the sculptor does reduce the cost of the citadel by 1, and then it can tap for 2 or whatever. You have to like have blue black lands. You need filter lands or Urborg to like.
Yeah,
get the
so
black.
You're saying with 3 lands in play, 3 lands that tap for black, and a Grand Architect and an Ethereum Sculptor, you can play Bolas the Citadel.
I guess Vault Scourge plus Chief Engineer convokes for the right color.
That's partly why they're there. I mean, if you just want the Scry effect, you have Artificer's Assistance in mono blue. So I don't know. I mean, I drew it up with and without the black creatures. I'm not totally sure about that. I'm not sure if Chief Engineer is actually a good card or not. So to Dave's point about like, yeah, is maybe blue steel is actually a decent shell if you add Karns. Like, yeah, if I were going to go down that route, the first thing I would do is I would add back the Lodestone Golems.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because those are the two best cards from Blue Steel, which I have immediately ruthlessly cut to make room for my bad combo. So if you're interested in sort of testing out, like, is Blue Steel good again with Karn, yeah, definitely include Ballistas and Lodestone Golems. Ballistas solve that problem that Damo was identifying of, like, it's a mana sink. It will receive as much architect mana as you have, but it's also fine on its own without the architect. So yeah, we don't have to go too deep on this one, because I think this is the one that I may or may not get around to testing this, depending on how much time I have. I'm going to start with the other ones. I think they're a little more promising.
So I actually kind of liked the Lantern Control variants. I thought they were all like sort of reasonable. Like I said, I'm not experienced at all, sort of like you, playing with or against these sort of Codex Shredder, Caller's Bell, Lantern of Insight decks. So I actually would have to like sit down and run through lists with them. It's not really my normal playstyle, so I can't say I'm more excited about one than the other. I like sort of where we were iterating towards in the Shape a New deck, away from Bolas the Citadel to the Teferi kind of lock combo. I don't know if we'd want to pursue that as part of this. If we're focused on Bolas the Citadel, that's fine. And then maybe that's just something to have in our back pocket if we want to keep kind of exploring sort of Teferi's ability to end games.
I owe Teferi some testing.
I have to say the blue-white Citadel list, like, I don't quite know how to make it an efficient 75, but it looks like something's there where you use Teferi Time Ravel to help protect everything. Bolas of Citadel becomes a clear combo victory with Children of Corlys, or at the very least you spew out a ton of value enough to guarantee the victory. And then you have a little bit more space for more canonical control cards than the Lantern Control build uses. That said, it's possible that there's no great way to make this into a 75 that really works, but it looks interesting.
Yeah, Ranger Captain protects you as well.
Yeah.
Also, you know what card is like sweet with Thraben Inspector and Blade Splicer and Ranger Captain of Eos?
Don't say it.
Restoration Angel is very sweet with all these cards. And Teferi gets value every time if they aren't an attacking deck. Teferi gets all kinds of value out of those as well. Maybe Teferi Time Ravelers is great. We should just be brewing around him every week.
You know, if you get to cast a Restoration Angel for free off Bolas of Citadel.
No, no, I mean, yeah.
It's sweet.
It's insane.
I mean.
Something for each of us here. Damon, go ahead, add a card. Add your favorite combo. Let's do it. Get a Stoneforge in there.
Well, sadly, Modern, but...
Someday, maybe.
Okay, well, thanks for hearing me out on these. I know I've been rambling, talking your ear off about these wilds and perhaps irresponsible Bolas of Citadel decks, but I'm definitely going to at least try the Lantern Shell and probably this Blue-White Shell as well. So hopefully we'll get some good testing in and see what's plausible and what's not.
Now, do you know when the new Modern Horizons cards, because several of your decks include cards from that set, is available online?
So my understanding is that the pre-release in paper is this weekend, and the way they've been doing it is that it's available online starting from either Thursday or Friday of the pre-release weekend. Yeah, it should be online by Friday. There's always some lag time where, you know, we use this card rental service, Mana Traders, and they don't have the new stuff available right away. So I might have to just pay full price and actually trade for these straight up from somebody at inflated prices. But I mean, the only cards we really need are the Goblin Engineers and maybe Urza if we go that route.
Ranger Captain of Eos.
Oh, no. Oh, he's going to be expensive,
it's
too.
It's a Mythic Rare. It says it's $8 online.
Well, that's pretty nice. Not that bad.
That's not real prices, though. Those are fake prices. Because we won't know the real price until the card's actually out online. Okay, well, we'll see.
Pre-order?
Not that I know of. Maybe. Actually, maybe. So, okay, well, hopefully we'll have time to test it out this weekend. I may be in Roanoke for the SCG Invitational. I haven't decided yet if I'm going to make that trip.
What is the format there, Daniel?
It is a split format, Modern and Standard. So if I go, I'll be repping one of our Faithless Brews, but I don't know what I'll do for Standard. Maybe just Mono Red. Who knows? Yeah, do you have any suggestions? What's our best deck so far?
Our best Bolas of Citadel deck? Or
I feel like you have to kind of run Niv-Mizzet just to let them know how it's about to go down.
I think I have to run
Niv-Mizzet. Niv-Mizzet in Standard, Niv-Mizzet in Modern.
That is my preference. Unfortunately, the Standard version is not good.
I'm a big fan of the Kiora's Dragons list, to be honest. I took that to a paper event. I went 4-2 with it. The deck felt like it could have made top 8, but it was close. Came in 11th.
What decks did you lose to, Damon?
I lost to Green-Black Elves. They just kind of killed me on turn 3. They just dumped their whole hand, including 3 Elvish Archdruids. Mm-hmm. I drew Stormbreath Dragon instead of Glorybringer. If it was a Glorybringer, I probably would have won. And my other loss, what was it to? I forget offhand. Oh, to Burn. I just got completely smoked by Burn. my sideboard was completely ill-prepared. I started testing that deck with like one Thragtusk main and then a couple more anti-burn cards in the sideboard. Still wouldn't be a great matchup, but might be like theoretically winnable as opposed to just absolutely impossible.
And don't trim on Anger of the Gods. People do still play elves.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's leave it at that for now. Yeah, I may have a tournament report or some testing, and we'll see what we can work out with Citadel.
We'll at least probably get some sweet screenshots out of it.
Well, hey, that's something for me to tweet out from the
Twitter. Silver lining, yeah.
Check that Twitter. It's going to have all kinds of...
I have to say, I'm not convinced yet that the decks we have here can win, like, a game, much less a match. But if they do, I will be very happily surprised.
I'm predicting a game or two, one in five matches.
I'm predicting a string of 5-0s personally. So.
Oh, I love it. There's only one way to find out.
Exactly. All right. Well, I look forward to it. So, gentlemen, we'll see you next week.
Sounds good. Take care, guys.
See you guys.
That'll do it for episode 6 of Faithless Brewing. All of the decks that we discussed today are posted in the show notes and in an accompanying post on the Modern subreddit at r/modernmagic. Search for a post by user cavedan2, that is myself. You can leave a comment there and I will try to reply. Email us, faithlessbrewing@gmail.com, or follow us on Twitter at our now functional Twitter account @faithlessmtg. Thanks for listening and see you next week.